Welcome to From Shadows to Light, a whole human approach to mental health, hosted by Olivia Catchman. This podcast series is centered around a book by the same name. 11 courageous individuals challenge the stigma around mental health and share their wisdom of a multidisciplinary, whole human approach to mental wellness that considers the body, mind, emotions, and spirit of the individual. And now, here's your host, Olivia Catchman, founder of the Phoenix Alchemy and Transformational Guide.
I am with my special guest, and today I want to introduce to you one of the most resilient and courageous people I've ever met in my life. Her name is Marilyn Bright Eyes, and she is going to tell you a remarkable tale. And I just want to, before we dive into Marilyn's story, I just want you to be aware that I've encouraged Marilyn to speak the truth, to say all the things that she needs to say, and it might trigger you. It will most likely disturb you. And I think it's really important to sit with that discomfort and to really sit with a heart opened and a grounded space so that you can truly hear a story that reflects the experience of so many Aboriginal people that experienced the horrors of colonialization in Canada. So without further ado, I introduce Marilyn Bright Eyes to you. How are you doing, Marilyn? I'm so glad you could be here today.
I'm doing good. I should take a break.
I know you work so hard doing the things that you do. So let's get started. For many of the listeners out there who may or may not be from Canada, I'd actually just like you to explain what a residential school in Canada was and just kind of go into some details of how it was one of those horrific acts of colonialism in Canada's history.
Okay, residential schools were created by John A. Macdonald. It was a way to kill the Indian in the child. And so they recruited nuns and priests to come save us and our evil ways. It meant taking children away from families. They figured that they would learn better if they weren't surrounded by families. So they were stripped of everything, their ID, their identity, their culture. They're often their hair is cut, which is very sacred. Their clothes were taken. Some of them got new clothes that was made by hand by their family, and that got taken away. And they were given these clothes that weren't even meant for like winter time, that they had to wear in the winter time as well, which wasn't warm. And they were set upon to learn English fast, English or French, and depending on where they were. So they weren't to have any contact at all with their family. If they were lucky and their family lived close enough, they could come visit maybe on holidays. But oftentimes they were not allowed to leave unless a family member can come get them. But then they had to ensure that that child was brought back on time, or else there's a lot of consequences. Jail, the rations were taken away. Back then, the Aboriginals weren't allowed to leave the land, leave the reserves, without an Indian agent's say. So they're given rations instead by the government, which were often spoiled and bug infested. So if they disobeyed, they could get that cut off.
Right. On so many levels, it was like there was a prison on the land that they were kept on. And then the children were literally incarcerated in these schools to basically brainwash them out of their own culture and language and upbringing.
Yeah. And it was, it wasn't nicely done. I've heard elders talk about kneeling in the corner for hours on grains of rice. You could get a strapping with a leather belt that was an inch thick and an inch wide. They use these wooden things that they would hit them with. They were beaten. There was a lot of sexual abuse done by the priests and the nuns. There was babies being born from the priests that had raped girls. And oftentimes they were 4 or 5 years old when they were ripped from their parents and brought to these places.
It's just so heartbreaking to hear the stories that have come out. And you had a piece in your chapter from Shadows to Light where you said residential school had left many broken homes and were a breeding ground for incest and family violence, to which there didn't seem any escape except through drugs and alcohol. Yeah. Yet in our bid for freedom, we ended up becoming everything we ran from. We became the monsters that we fled from.
Yeah. Because our families, and this goes back at least 3 generations for some. So our grandparents were molesting their grandchildren, in some cases. Aunts and uncles were molesting nieces and nephews. Moms and dads were molesting their children and beating them, and everything they learned in residential school they did on each other, which is worse, because it's a betrayal of family, it's a betrayal of trust, it's a betrayal of security. And many of Aboriginals that have had family that gone through that have went through that betrayal in one sense or another.
Now, I know you had mentioned that both your mother and your father were sent away to residential school. Yes. And although you didn't get to really know your father, you lived with your mother and she never talked about it. At what point did you actually learn that your mother had been through that?
She did talk about it, but it was so hard to believe. I was in foster care when I was young and forced to go to like Sunday school and everything. But I was abused there too, right? So but you think, you're told of how good these people were and how much they wanted to help us poor Indians, that when she started talking about it, it was hard to believe. And it wasn't until I actually went through inner city high school with Joe, when I was talking with Joe that ran it. He was, even before he started the school, in the drama group, he was telling us about residential schools. That's how I learned, was through Joe. And then I put the pieces together of what my mom was talking about. But even then, it was hard to comprehend. I didn't believe it. I thought she was making it up. And then when I moved, before I moved, like when I was in, taking my GED in Norquist, I found out just through my own searching, because they weren't teaching it. So I had to search it on my own, residential schools. And then I really found out what it was like, just the tip of the iceberg though.
I can imagine it would be so difficult as someone who's like a child or a teenager and even a young adult to possibly get your head wrapped around the violence that your parents and some of your older siblings experienced.
I didn't even know that my sisters had went through.
Right. There's this vow of silence.
Yeah. They didn't talk about it. They didn't talk at all about it. My mom was the only one that was talking about it. And even then, when I was in school, the first thing I looked up was the Trail of Tears, because that's more known than the residential schools.
Can you just, for the listener, share what the Trail of Tears is?
The Cheyenne, I believe it was. They were moved from one from their village are their place that they're staying, and because of there's a gold found on their land, so the governments were ordered to move them, or ordered the troops to move them a long ways by foot with whatever they were carrying. Many died along the way from exhaustion because they had to walk in the rain while the soldiers, you know, rode their horses and stuff, and wagons, and people yeah. would die where they fell, right?
And that's not the only case that happened. I've heard of so many instances from across Canada where people were displaced again and again. And also the Highway of Tears is another one.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that atrocity?
The Highway of Tears is where a lot of murdered and missing women were they went missing on this one road in BC, a road that they traveled on, and they were preyed upon by this Pinkerton guy who would hold them hostage for a while, kill them, and feed them to his pigs. So there was a lot that went missing on that road. Now they have signs that are saying don't hitchhike, don't walk alone. They even have some buses that will bus people from smaller communities to towns so that they aren't put at risk like that.
Yeah, so these are just a few of the examples of incredible abuse of all of your people. And again, it's so hard to comprehend how mistreated and how unjust the experiences have been. Can you go a little bit more into how your foster care experience really shaped you in a different way?
My mom was an alcoholic. She would, it was a series of things that got us on the child welfare's radar. I think it started with my mom's rape, which I saw. Then I got sick, was in the hospital. And then shortly afterwards, we were taken. I was 6 years old. We were put in the foster home. The first one was good, but they couldn't keep us. So we got moved. And the second one that we went to, we later found out that it was reported. And they knew about the history of this place, but they still put us in there. The child welfare worker knew everything about it, and
they still placed you in this family.
Yeah, even though there was many reports of abuse, and this one, it was I learned how to give head to an adult male when I was 6 years old. We lived there till I was eight, so we just turned seven I was six turning seven when we got there. I think it was my birthday that we got moved. I think we were there for about a year and a half or 2 years, I don't know. And my brother had been tied and raped by this man. And I think the mother knew. She would pick us like one at a time to take with her somewhere, and one of us would end up being at home with him by ourselves. My brother ended up getting away. We would get visits with our mom, but I don't remember much of it. My brother was one that told me about how it was before he died, that we ate their scraps. Like we would sit at the counter as they sat at the table and as a family, because they had two boys, and they would eat their food. And then whatever was left over, we got to eat. And oftentimes I remember going to bed hungry. I would cry. And my brother taught me how to swallow air so that I would feel full enough to fall asleep and stop crying. And he'd use a hockey stick on our hands when we were bad. So we weren't allowed to sit on their furniture. We slept on a mattress in the basement. We had our own bathroom down there, and we had to take baths together.
So it really, what you're really explaining is pretty much how your foster care experience, where you were supposed to be safe and you were supposed to be, you know, saved in some way from your experience at home, literally was like a residential school experience.
Yeah, it would have been safer. Even though I was being mistreated at home, it would have been safer at home than I was in the foster care system. Because that really fucked up my brother. Like, sorry, I don't know if I can swear or not, but it really changed him. He went from my protector to my monster, my living monster, who later on took my virginity when I was 9. So, yeah, that kind of experience can change a person for the rest of their life. Like, there's no going back. And he could never go to that place of forgiveness and trust. He could never change.
I know you said that after your brother had raped you, it became almost normal to be sexualized and abused. That just became...
It was...
relentless.
It was before that.
Even before that.
Because I had a cousin, my auntie's son, who started when I was little. And it wasn't all the time. It was only when my mom went to Saddle Lake. That's what I mean. Like... residential school, it changed everybody. It changed the community. It changed the whole community where aunties and uncles and cousins were abusing each other.
I think that's what a lot of people don't understand, is that all those behaviors were so normalized in residential school.
It became taught at home.
And then through a generation or two, that continued to be normal. And
it still happens today. There are still little kids getting hurt by their families who are still trying to struggle and cope with the fact that they got traumatized or abused by their own family. Many escape to their addictions, leaving their children to get taken by family, by social services, hoping that their life will be better with them. Knowing that they're not better with them, you know, like,
right,
because they can't look after them because they don't know how, you know, they want to, and
right,
they don't know how, and sometimes they just feel that it's better. Like, that's the only thing I can think of, because I'm the only one that raised my children out of all my siblings and my nieces, my two nieces and my niece and nephew that I grew up with. They couldn't be parents.
And I guess that's the thing, is that if you've never been shown love or kindness or respect, and all you've ever witnessed is the opposite, it's hard to become a good parent if all you've witnessed was normal to you.
And it's hard to figure out where to start. Like, I didn't know where to start. I wanted to change for so long, and I had no idea where to even begin. Like, there was no, you have to do this, you have to do that. There was no one that said, you know what, Marilyn, you need to let go of your family and your friends in order to change your life. No one said that to me. I had to figure that out by myself.
I'm sure there's a lot of things you had to figure out by yourself. Yeah. It felt like in your story, there was quite a remarkable change. You had the experience where you tried to cut your heart out and you were only 13.
Yeah.
There was just so much pain. And shortly after that experience, you mentioned meeting Joe and being able to be part of a drama group. And that was a really important change for you, because at the time you were prostituting yourself on the streets and you really were lost. So can you talk about how that drama group and the leadership there was able to actually help you express your experiences and understand that they were so wrong?
Yeah. Joe was an awesome, he's an awesome man. He gave me my voice back. First 13 years of my life were conditioned to be silenced. And that wasn't just because of residential teachings. It was also understanding that if you speak to the wrong people, then child welfare will get involved and you have the potential of being taken away and put into a place where it's 10 times worse than what you were in. So I had to, Joe fostered that, but he had to gain our trust, and we'd do drama exercises. We'd have sharing circles. We would smudge. He taught me how to smudge. He would feed us. And that was one of the most important things, food. When you're homeless or when you're living in an addicted family, there's food is always a problem. So I know for me, that was what got me hooked on joining the drama group was the food, knowing that there's going to be like fresh fruit and stuff that I don't get at home very much. And we would do drama exercises. Like, he wasn't planning on doing this for a long time. This was just something that he was going to, a project that he was going to do maybe for a year or so. But then it became more because we actually started making plays within maybe not even a year. After I started, we actually were able to start doing plays, and we had our first performance when I was like 14 at the Mustard Seed.
And what did it feel like to be able to reclaim your voice and tell that story on stage?
Scary.
I bet.
Scary because you don't think that people are going to believe you, you know, and that's the big thing. Is that belief, and Joe believed us. You know, we could tell him that stones turn to water and he would believe us, you know, and that was important as well, because then that gained our trust and we can actually be honest and truthful and let him know where we're coming from and what we've been through. Like, I didn't tell him all of my dark secrets because I was so busy trying to hide from them and still that fear of, you know, he's not going to like me knowing that my brother was raping me. Still that day, you know, when I'd go see the drama group, and it was like, it was just peeling back onions of layers of lies and misconceptions so that we can hide and not really, you know, those walls that we built. It took a while for him to get those, most of those, not all of them.
Right. That was a real turning point for you, wasn't it?
It was. It was. And it went against everything that I was taught. You know, for one thing, speaking up was a no-no. You know, that was the first thing you learn growing up is shut up, be quiet, sit still. And no one's interested in what you have to say. And that these are just things that my family learned the hard way through the governments, through the healthcare systems, through everybody, that every agency that they had went to would not believe them, trust them, or honor their willingness to change or become different. But that trust, that knowing that what they're saying is true and trying to help them or have any kind of empathy is a starting point, and that's not out there. That's not in the system. There is no empathy in the system.
But there is empathy between, let's say, yourself and someone you're helping who's in a similar situation now.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're able to give those people that you work with now an opportunity to be heard and believed. And that makes all the difference in the world. In your chapter, Marilyn, you had this profound statement. It was, silence is death. Even if it's hard to speak up, even if people try to shut you up, find a way to share your stories, to bring them to light. It's not the end, but that's where the healing starts. Can you share some insights about what that means to you and to the healing journeys of everyone out there.
I think that, like, when I really started my healing journey was when I was in that women's group that empowered me. And that was a beautiful woman that told me that when you share your story, you are giving others permission to share theirs. And that is what empowerment is. When you step into your empowerment is when you can speak up and talk without shame. And, well, the fear is going to be there, but just that act alone is empowerment. And for me, that was like light bulb moment, and everything just changed, shifted, because that's what I had been doing since I was a teenager in the drama group, was telling my story, but telling it through drama, through play. And this was actually the first time that I was actually starting to actually use my story to help empower others.
So really, it was like through, in some sense, like art therapy that really helped you to turn a corner.
I didn't quite understand that aspect of it until I was in counseling later on. Just how profound art therapy is. And that I had been doing it all this time.
Yeah, expression is empowerment. So that I always think that if we're able to look at it from a different perspective somehow, and often through art is a good way, we can shift things within ourselves. So I'm really happy you had that chance, especially with Joe in the drama group.
Yes. I mean, that was my beginning. And it was each step that I took along the way that helped, you know, make that shift and that change. And like, I'm still growing. I'm still healing. Like, you really don't, your healing never ends. And especially if you've been through this kind of trauma of colonization, then your healing generation, you're really working on not just yourself, but your children.
So besides doing things to do with art and with expression, what are some of the other things that have helped you out so much in your own recovery? I totally get that healing never stops, but what are the things that really have worked for you?
I took a lot of trainings. The women's group, the facilitator training that I took, that was my first leap. And then after that, it was baby steps, doing workshops on grief and loss and the blanket ceremonies and just all those things that are out there. There's so many resources for natives, like Bent Arrow, Boyle Street. They have, like, using my culture, going to sweats and the teachings that are around all of that. It's just a combination of everything that I was fortunate enough to get into. Because I was told that I could never sober up. Like, you can never sober up on the reserve is what I had heard. And I proved them wrong because I did.
And kudos to you for being able to do that. Because obviously you have to really face yourself and all your emotions and all the traumas when you're not dampening them with addiction.
Well, it's more than just addiction, though. I think that the most important thing that I had to do was I had to step away from family and friends that were negative in my life, that couldn't back me up when I was doing my best to be positive. And that was hard, because then you realize just how alone you are when people aren't looking at you as one of them, as one of the addicted or one of the hurt. And like, people like to keep you stuck. And that was one of the things I realized. People like to keep you stuck, because if you move forward and they don't, then they would have to look at themselves and see why it is that I could do it, but they couldn't. And so rather than look at themselves, they will sabotage and do what they can to keep you stuck with them, right? Because misery likes company.
I can really appreciate how much determination to lead a better life is required to make those steps to actually go off on your own and say, I have to break these cycles. And I know your children have been a major motivation for you to break those cycles.
They have been. Like, yeah. I've had my children so that I can live a different life. I wanted to be loved unconditionally. And I knew my children would give me that. I had to find a way to step away from my family in order to give them the unconditional love they needed. So to do that, I had to be selfish for once and do do what it took to straighten out. But they were my crutch, because once I sobered up and once I was alone, all I had was them. And so I kept them by my side and used them as my excuses to not, you know, because I didn't want to be having them standing outside the liquor store while I went in and grabbed another bottle. I didn't want them outside the crack dealers waiting for me to go grab my hit. So I kept them with me as my security blanket, because then if I had them by my side, then I wouldn't be going into those places, because that's not where I wanted them to be. Yeah, they're what keeps me going, keeps me sober, and keeps me alive, honestly, because I've had my breaking points with the deaths. I had a suicide plan, and that started before I even started at Boyle Street. I had my plan, and I was what kept me from doing it with my children, because I didn't want to leave them alone and at the mercy of child welfare. So I had no choice. I had to keep going.
Well, you're a very courageous human and, you know, an incredible mother for making that decision to begin breaking those cycles of intergenerational trauma and to be the best mother that you could be, no matter where you've been at in the journey. I know you've always done the very best that you could have as a mother. And your children are really lucky that you've been such a warrior and that you've been able to overcome so much.
I honestly think that I'm the lucky one, because they still love me in spite of the trauma that I have put them through. And like my oldest, he's seen a lot. He's been through a lot, because I was still drinking when I had him with me, and he's like my rock. So is my 18-year-old, and it's like they're all there for me, and they're rooting me on. Like, they still love me, and that's the thing I love about children, is that they will still love you no matter what you do.
If yeah, I just think that you have created a really beautiful family. And if you were to reflect and give a message out to anyone out there who's listening about how to continue to just rise up and face your traumas and face your mental health challenges, what would that message be?
Don't lose your voice. Don't allow your trauma, your fear, your hurt to silence you. Keep talking. And if people aren't listening, find the people that will listen, that will hold space for you. Because when you talk, you are spreading out your burdens onto their shoulders, and they can help you carry it. So talk. And then talking will help you figure out what's next. What can I do next?
Yeah, thank you so much for that, Marilyn. I'm really happy that you've been able to find those solid people to share with that could help you carry that burden. And now I know you're doing such amazing work as a support worker and being able to help in the same way that those people did for you. And I just want to say thank you so much for offering your voice to From Shadows to Light. And I wish you the very best in all that's to come ahead, because I know you're still writing an amazing life story. And yeah, I know that you're going to continue helping many, many more people.
I really thank you for this opportunity you gave me to share my voice in a different way. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for all that you've offered, and I wish you all the best.
Olivia Catchman is here to help serve those who are ready to rise up and feel the freedom of living their fullest potential, a life beyond their wounds. Olivia creates a safe, sacred place and intuitively guides people to let go of their limitations and suffering so they can reclaim their power and rebirth themselves anew. Her offerings include individual and group healing ceremonies, transformational energy work, spiritual dance, and embodiment practices. If you would like to know more, please visit www.phoenixalchemy.net. That's www.phoenixalchemy.net.